from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The American Enlightenment is often viewed as a singular era bursting with new ideas as the United States sought to assert itself as a new republic free of the British monarchy. In her book, American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason, Stanford historian Caroline Winter says the myth and romanticization of an American Enlightenment was invented during the Cold War to calm fears about totalitarianism overseas. We'll talk to her about her theory of Enlightenment and how it applies to today's politics. Join us for Forum. It's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Caroline Winter is professor of humanities and directs the Stanford Humanities Center at Stanford, and she joins us for this Forum Hour. She's also a recipient of the Smithsonian's American Ingenuity Award and has a book out titled American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. Joins us for this Forum Hour in studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with that Enlightenment's plural, because people think of American Enlightenment, they think of it as something singular. You say it's not a concrete event, and as far as its singularity, pure invention.
That's exactly right. The idea of the American Enlightenment was invented in the immediate post-World War II era. In fact, at the height of the Cold War, amid rising American anxieties about the totalitarian threat being manifested in Europe, especially the Soviet Union. And we see the first appearance of the term the American Enlightenment in that period. And it was really crafted as a kind of bomb shelter of ideas rather than concrete to reassure Americans that even though there might be a totalitarian threat abroad, Americans had a national legacy of freedom and democracy stemming from the American Revolution, and that they didn't have to worry about going down that dark road. So it was a really a national reassurance in the same way that Superman was in some ways.
Yeah, Superman indeed was. And I like that concrete, because I think of bomb shelters as being made out of concrete. But this was a narrative that was fabricated. I mean, a lot of your attribution has to do with a woman named Adrian. Is it Koch or Koch?
I think it's Koch.
Yeah, who wrote this book in 65. Tying the founders really to this whole idea and giving them all the credit and their great wisdom, so forth.
Yes, it was Adrian Koch, who is really strangely forgotten today. She wrote almost 40 books, so it's a reminder to be very modest about one's abilities as a scholar. One can be forgotten after writing 40 books. But she was the person who really single-handedly established the founding fathers, the big five especially, you know, probably the first five that are coming to your listeners' minds, as the very center of the American Enlightenment, this mythical era that she was calling the American Enlightenment. And these five founders used the American Revolution as their cradle of this ideological heritage of freedom. So her really important move was not just to create this idea of the American Enlightenment, but then to establish the American Revolution, a political event, as the very core of this mythical construct.
And as you point out in your book, the founders were kind of unsure about that revolution and, you know, how it was going to move forward. I mean, in the sense of suddenly they're out without a monarchy, they're on their own, and they have to establish whatever is in the Constitution and make it endurable and so forth. I mean, they were brilliant men in many respects, all men. As Cokie Roberts has pointed out, though, women did play a central role more than has been given attention by a lot of historians. But this ties in, it seems to me, also with American exceptionalism, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's about American exceptionalism. It suggests that the American Enlightenment is on a fundamentally different track than the European Enlightenment. And Europeans have a very combative relationship with their own Enlightenment. They struggle with it. They fight about it. They are not sure whether it's legacy was positive. Many Europeans think that there is a very dark legacy of the Enlightenment in Europe, setting them on a path of scientism and totalitarianism that, you know, that culminated in the horrors of Nazi Germany. This is so different from the narrative of the American Enlightenment, that it suggests that Americans are a people of progress, and that progress began during the American Revolution, and that everything that Americans do is a kind of or should be a narrative of progress, and that when there is no progress, it's somehow a deviation from the natural course of how American history should move.
So as you say, the European idea of enlightenment, or whatever we want to call it, let's get into the semantics of enlightenment, but it's tied to the past, America to the future.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful way of looking at it.
And we look at it also as something that, at least for quite some time, was not reciprocal, but maybe more reciprocal than we are willing to admit at this point, or than historians have actually given credit for.
Well, one of Adrian Koch's other theses, and this was embellished by other scholars at that time, was to suggest that the American Enlightenment was really fundamentally a derivation of the European Enlightenment, and that it brought these European-derived ideas to a kind of culmination. So the American Enlightenment was the dramatic and beautiful and righteous culmination.
The full realization, without a monarch, without a throne behind
it. Exactly. The realization of all of the Enlightenment ideas that had been brewing in Europe for about 100 years. The trouble with that scenario, as appealing as it is that it neglects the many, many decades of transatlantic conversations between the Americas, not just North America, but Spanish America, Portuguese America, French America, with Europe from the moment of contact in 1492 onward. You know, the ideas aren't just getting on a ship once in 1775 to inspire the revolutionaries. There had been a transatlantic conversation, a very rich, a very extensive, a very detailed one going on for decades.
Maybe it's time that you could talk with us about your work with the Smithsonian, because that ties in exactly with what we're talking about now. I mean, with Benjamin Franklin and all this material that you've worked with them. Give us some background.
Sure. Well, Ben Franklin, along with some of the other American revolutionaries, lived at an extraordinary moment when the possibilities of letter writing expanded hugely. So Ben Franklin and other people like Thomas Jefferson were in the first great age where people during a lifetime could send and receive on the order of 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 letters. The wonders of digitization have now made all those letters accessible to scholars. So for the first time, we can actually map the correspondence network of some of the major figures of America in the 18th century and Europe as well. So we're getting a much better sense for how the world of ideas functioned in the 18th century. We know what many of the ideas are, of course, but how those ideas circulated and the extent to which these transatlantic conversations could occur has only now been recently revealed by scholarship. So we mapped the social network of Benjamin Franklin, and it was a quite extraordinary finding.
It's metadata, really, isn't it?
It is metadata. It is data about things like when you sent a letter, where you sent it to. So we were able to establish all kinds of things about not just the extent of Ben Franklin's network, which reached not only to England, but into France and Germany and Spain. There's even a letter that goes to North Africa, but not to an African person. That's actually to an English lady who's living in North Africa. But we also were able to clearly show the limits, the geographical limits of his social network. He does not have letters going into Spanish America. He does not have letters going into Africa. He does not have letters going into Asia. This is not in any way to diminish Ben Franklin, but it's to put on the table a whole new series of questions. So whose letters did go to those places? And we were able to find all kinds of other things about Ben Franklin that we may have intuitively known, of course, by reading the letters, but we were able to establish with some greater certainty.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with Caroline Winter. She's professor in humanities and directs Stanford Humanities Center at Stanford, and has a new book out, American Enlightenments. It is described as a bold reassessment of the concept of an American Golden Age in the years following the Revolutionary War, and it ties right in with the Cold War in terms of her thesis. Let's talk about that some more. I mean, especially when you think about American exceptionalism and the idea of the American Enlightenment, as mythic as it may be, think about things like Manifest Destiny.
Manifest Destiny is another trope from the 19th century about America's exceptional role in essentially fulfilling a divine mission to be the greatest nation in the world. All of these narratives, you know, the American Enlightenment, Manifest Destiny, every nation has them. So we should not necessarily get rid of them. We should be aware that they exist and that they are constructs of certain times and places. And what that allows us to do is to have the ability to return to the time period before those constructs were put into place and to see a little more realistically what was going on. So the American Enlightenment as a mythical construct of the Cold War era is very satisfying to us in many ways. President Obama has very often invoked this idea in very inspiring ways.
Patriotism, nationalism, chauvinism, I mean, it all ties together, doesn't it?
It all ties together. But what happened when I actually returned to the 18th century to see what those Americans who did not have the mythical construct of the American Enlightenment at their disposal, because it had not yet been invented, was that their use of the term enlightened with a small e was not nationalistic. It was
polymathic, really.
It was polymathic. Yeah. It was not just about political things. It was a desire to become something in time. It was a desire to improve the human condition. These were the first prophets of tomorrow. These were the first people to imagine themselves beyond a world of absolutism, of monarchism, and of traditions inherited from the past, popes, kings, etc., and to imagine that it was not in the afterlife that we should achieve happiness. It was in the here and now, in the span of a human life, in the container of human society, rather than in heaven, that we as human beings could build a better world. That was a shockingly new, inspiring, and deeply frightening idea.
Because that's mainly 18th century you're talking about, when reason started to be given much more weight than, shall we say, scripture.
Yes.
More secularization.
More secularization. And it was a very exciting idea that you could use your own God-given human reason and your five senses to make the world a better place through a variety of programs and policies. But that also put a huge burden on people, because what if your five senses were telling you the wrong thing? What if your eyes deceived you? And in fact, many of the documents, the Constitution, for example, that we think of as being these solid moments of national assurance, were crafted by people who had deep uncertainties. James Madison regularly manifested his uncertainty about the ability of language to convey ideas clearly to other people. What a terrifying idea that was. By resurrecting that moment, I think it's a reminder to us that our national legacy is of trying to find out the truth, but being aware of our limitations to do so. And this is a very wonderful thing.
Yeah, I couldn't help thinking when I was reading your book about when you were writing about Madison and his uncertainty of language, you know, it almost sounds like what we call post-structuralism in linguistics. But also it sounds to me vaguely reminiscent of the fact that we have strict constructionists who say we have to believe in this language completely. And yet here's Madison, one of the founding fathers, saying, boy, I'm at sea here a lot where language is concerned. A lot of these signifiers don't take a word like enlightenment. I mean, and he does take a word like enlightenment, right?
He does. And so when you first realize this. It's like falling down through the ice into the dark water of epistemology. But then what you realize is the second part of Madison's ideas on this is that meaning is established through human conversation. How do we go about clarifying our ideas and our meanings? We talk to one another. We talk to one another at length, recognizing that we all share certain commonalities, but that we all share differences of opinion, of interpretation, and of understanding, and that the most valuable outcome then of the 18th century is an American tradition of reasonable conversation through educated analysis. This is much more reassuring to me than a national tradition of 100% certainty about everything. That just seems very unlikely to me.
You also bring up the idea of enlightenment in the context of slavery and that horrid institution. But to some extent, enlightenment became, or the idea of being enlightened and moving forward, progressing, at a certain point became more and more associated with the abolition of slavery.
It did. Well, of course, if you ask any American today what is the enlightened attitude toward slavery, they will say it is to oppose it. And this is the legacy of the abolitionists who, for the first time in the late 18th century, began to utter objections to the institution of slavery. So that's one way of seeing enlightenment and slavery. But there was also a group of people in the South who said, no, in fact, to be enlightened about slavery was, in fact, to treat your slaves better. This strand of enlightenment has faded out of American discourse, but it was there in the 18th and early 19th centuries. It inspired the pro-slavery activists who opposed the anti-slavery the abolitionists of the early 19th century. So going back again into the 18th century to resurrect those forgotten voices opens up a multiplicity of enlightenments, some which we are not proud of today, but they are there.
Talking to Caroline Winterer, and again, she's professor of humanities and directs the Stanford Humanities Center at Stanford and has a book out called American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. Let me invite you to join this discussion. In fact, an opportunity for you to not only raise questions and comments about American enlightenment or enlightenments, but also to simply be part of this conversation. We do welcome your involvement. Our toll-free number is available now. That number is 866-733-6786. If you wish to join the program, you can call us at the number and become a part of it. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. Welcome your questions or comments by email, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, we welcome your involvement in the program, so feel free to join us now. And we're talking not only about American enlightenment, but also about maybe what the founding fathers really had in mind when they started talking about words like enlightenment. And what they had in mind, it seems to me, in many respects, was just moving more and more into an independence, obviously, that the whole Revolutionary War was about, but also establishing fundamental truths as they saw it. And fast forward to the Cold War, gets carried away. It's taken into a whole different dimension.
Well, carried away, I think, is one way of looking at it. But it's important to be respectful of the constructs of other eras, including the Cold War. They weren't necessarily wrong to say there was this era called the American Enlightenment. It wasn't using the categories of the 18th century. But there was a national ideological emergency in the Cold War era. And as a historian, I think it's important to try to understand other eras on their own terms. For me, as an 18th century historian, it was just enormously liberating to my own studies to realize that this thing that I thought was a given, a natural category, the American Enlightenment, was in fact something that had been invented in the middle of the 20th century, and that I shouldn't necessarily get rid of it. And I think a lot of your listeners will probably find it very distressing to get rid of the notion of the American Enlightenment. But it's important to know that it is a modern construction and that there was a rather different understanding of enlightenment in the 18th century. We can hold both of those two things in our heads at the same time.
Well, also, when we think of the different notion of the enlightened America, we also, I mean, you get us into things like mastodons and sea fossils, seashell fossils and so forth. I mean, it's again the idea of the polymath.
The polymath. There were no academic disciplinary boundaries in the 18th century the way there are today. And so there were a lot of people running around who could aspire and, in fact, be interested in everything. And Thomas Jefferson is probably the most famous
example of those people.
He really is a polymath among polymaths. But you just scratch the surface of some of the other founders. John Adams loved to go to museums. He was really interested in caterpillars and astronomy. James Madison hung animal pictures on the walls of his plantation, Montpelier. So a lot of these guys were polymaths. And what I tried to do in this book was
They were also Spencerian men, you know, Renaissance men. They were men who wanted to combine all of the great inquisitiveness about whatever subjects are out there and learn and be learned and be erudite, but at the same time be physically fit and able.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas Jefferson was a great advocate of long walks every day around wherever you happen to be.
But also an advocate about what you alluded to before, that is a more humane notion of slavery.
Well, so he's a difficult case, this Jefferson, is that he was one of the great promoters of the new idea of enlightenment, of achieving happiness within the earthly realm as much as one could. And yet he himself, over the course of his life, at any given moment owned 200 slaves at Monticello. And so he's also an example of the very contradictory nature of people in the 18th century. But what I was trying to really do was to show that enlightenment was not just a political program of the American Revolution. Of course, that was part of it. But there was science and art and literature as part of the project of creating perfect societies in the 18th century.
Let me bring a caller on here, and we go first to you, Ted. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, you're just exactly where I'd like to speak to about Thomas Jefferson. Could you speak to the influence of the book, the long-lost book, The Nature of Things by Lucretius on Thomas Jefferson's views?
Oh, I don't know if I can in particular. Can I ask you what it is in particular that you wanted to know?
You should read Stephen Greenberg's book.
Yeah, okay. We can refer you to that.
Yeah. Well, I've read his book, and I was just very, very influenced. I've always been amazed at the influence on, you know, as far as Thomas Jefferson, including the pursuit of happiness as opposed to the right to property in the three important rights in the United States.
Well, you raise a good point, Ted, because the pursuit of happiness is something that you don't find in too many major documents in any place in the world except America, which does suggest a kind of exceptionalism in many people's minds.
Yeah, and well, I can talk about the pursuit of happiness. One of the things that I say in the introduction to the book is that we actually misunderstand the 18th century view of happiness, which was much broader than it is today. Today we have a private, personal view of happiness as self-fulfillment. But in the 18th century, they not only had that view, but they had a very public view of happiness, what they called social happiness or public happiness. And you could not achieve private happiness without social happiness first. So when we read the Declaration of Independence and its ideal of the pursuit of happiness, I think Thomas Jefferson actually had both meanings in mind, and we've lost that second meaning now in the 21st century.
We're going to come back and talk more with our guest, Caroline Winter, her book, American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. Feel free to join the program. You can call us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Or tweet us. Twitter handles @KQED Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Stanford historian Caroline Winter. And she says the myth and romanticization of an American enlightenment was invented during the Cold War, essentially to calm fears about totalitarianism overseas. And we're talking to her about her theory and hearing her thoughts on what she views as America's multiple periods of enlightenments, in fields ranging from farming to religion, and she is professor at Stanford and directs the Humanities Center there. Her book is entitled American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. She's also the author of The Mirror of Antiquity and The Culture of Classicism, and she'll be speaking, mark this down, it's a few months hence, on January 17th at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park in partnership with Peninsula Arts and Letters, and that time will be at 7:30 p.m. Let me go to your calls, more of our callers. Marjorie, you're on. Good morning.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And great topic, especially right now. And so during the Cold War, in the 1960s, I worked at Yale on the Franklin Papers. I indexed about 4 volumes. This was at the pre-revolutionary time. And his work on science, this while I was a science writer at Yale in chemistry department, and was amazed at all the major discoveries and uses that they were making, that Franklin and his... I always thought they were mythic, and I want to read your book and find out more about why you think maybe they weren't. They were certainly creating a reality. Franklin, wasn't he the first sort of rock star, especially in Paris? I worked on Madame Lopez's book, Mon Cher Papa, about how he was idolized there. And I was thinking, what would Franklin have to say to Trump's doubting climate change? Or how would he go about talking to people to get some better agreement? It's fascinating. And I also, my final question, sorry I'm so long, are you teaching an online course or anything that... It sounds like you have this material that I've wondered about all my life, and I'd love to learn more.
Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for indexing some of the Franklin papers. I'm very grateful to you personally.
At Yale, who is your publisher, by the way.
Yes, exactly.
This book is published by Yale Press.
This is wonderful. And Franklin, I'm glad you mentioned this for our listeners. It was indeed the most famous American in the 18th century. And this was not only something that we knew intuitively, but that now we've been able to establish with social network analysis. He actually became famous for his book on electricity that was published in 1751. But then when he moved for almost 20 years to London, which was the center of the largest empire in the history of the world, including Rome, he became the most famous person in the terms that Facebook would recognize today, which is through the personal connections of the letter. And by establishing those connections in London, when he left London in 1775 and went to Paris later that year, he could capitalize on those personal connections to then become the most famous American in the world in Paris.
Well, Parisians liked him too because of his libertine ways, I think.
His libertine ways, indeed. And he actually had pretty good French as well. So that was helpful. So what would he say to Donald Trump? I have no idea. But I think that he would encourage the kind of educated, open-ended debate and self-questioning and a certain amount of self-doubt that was a trademark of the Franklin way of writing letters. You will know better than anyone that a letter from Ben Franklin is a monument to human charm and inquisitiveness. It can sometimes range over several languages, and it is always in the spirit of interchange. I tell you something that I think, and then I welcome your response in return. So I think he would say, stop the one-way tweeting, engage in more dialogue.
And are you going to be doing an online course that she should be
I wish I were doing an online course. I'm teaching in the Master of Liberal Arts program for returning students in winter at Stanford, so she could look into that. But it's something to consider, so maybe I'll do it in the future.
And let me thank her for the call. Did you work with Steve Wasserman?
I did.
You did?
Yes.
Yeah, because
yes.
He's here now. You know, he's come to Heyday Books.
I'm talking at Heyday Books on Friday. So.
Well, is that open to the public?
I don't think it is, unfortunately.
Well, our callers are part of the public, and their calls are, again, they can join us openly. And let's have one of them aboard here. James from Nevada City. You're on.
Hi, good morning. I'm presently reading Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth, Uncensored Writings, recently published, never published until 50 years after his death.
You're finding them dark because they are dark.
Well, I think through darkness, or what one might describe as an intellectual contempt, as a necessary quality to barge through all the incredible hypocrisy and lies and fabrications that regard our notion of enlightenment, for instance. I think his analysis of Christianity, for instance, pointing out that the Old Testament God was all about mass murder, rape, and sex and death, sort of like ISIS. And then the New Testament is all warm and fuzzy. Anyway, he gets into that in sort of this incredible way that allows me to finally get my arms around what the hell went wrong with religion in this country, as far as I know it, and throughout much of the world. But his analysis of what's going on in that period of time, the same one you're discussing a little bit later, mid-1800s, but anyone who enjoys Mark Twain is certainly going to get a kick out of this, and his darkness doesn't bother me at all. It's like, let's get to the bottom of this.
No, there's humor there. He was very angry at God, though. Read the biographies and you realize just how deep that anger was, but also very dark. Mysterious Stranger was published around, this somewhat earlier, but, you know, the darkness was there. Thank you for that call. And as long as he brings up Twain and darkness, let's go to that side of the so-called Enlightenment and Enlightenments. Suddenly Satan was free from at least religious discourse to a great degree, so they had to deal with Enlightenment in terms of for example, let's go back to the Cold War in terms of the Soviet hegemony.
Well, the Enlightenment in the 18th century is really the first age to try to ask the question, what does it mean to have your belief rooted in reason and nature? How do we get rid of some of the superstructure of religion and go back to original principles? So these are some of the first people to imagine that we might look to ancient pagan societies like the Egyptians to try to establish an original, you know, religion of sun worship that antedates the corruptions of Christianity. And it's, of course, the French who go crazy for this during the French Revolution. And they even get rid of the Christian calendar, right? And they substitute this calendar of nature instead. And one of the things that they do as part of that is to get rid of all of the depressing things about Satan and the Old Testament, and liberating in some ways. But then again, when you get rid of the deity and the anti-deity, you put a lot of new burden onto mere human beings for the pursuit of social perfection. So this is the era in the 18th century when they begin to come up with the kinds of classification schemes, counting human populations, measuring them, you go here, you go there, these kinds of things to try to create what they called a science of social happiness. And they even have a quantum. They call it the quantum of happiness. They invent the word statistics in the 1790s to try to use themselves, use human beings, use human reason to try to do the work that they had before assigned to God himself. And that was an act of extraordinary chutzpah in some ways. But it also led to what you are calling the dark side of the Enlightenment. So racial classification schemes that some people would argue led straight to Nazi
eugenics.
Eugenics, those roots can be traced to these very optimistic theorists of the 18th century who dared to imagine for the first time in human history that it was human beings within the short span of a human life who could create perfection now. And I always tell my students that one of the key words of the 18th century is now. That word is everywhere because it stopped being about the afterlife. It started being about the now. And so when we then move to the Cold War and we see a different reckoning with what the now means and what the capacities for human beings are, we can better appreciate why they were struggling with the totalitarian menace.
Chris, when we go back, also we have to factor in the European influence, again, on America from across the pond. We had Leibniz, you know, the best of all possible worlds and all the rest of that, which really ties in with it's maybe more American optimism than anything else, a kind of optimism and belief in the human capacity for achievement and, again, excellence. Let me go to more of our calls, and we go to Lafayette, and we welcome Harry to the forum program. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning. I'm a psychiatrist from Sri Lanka, and my reading of the Enlightenment in America is I read a book called A Metaphysical Club, but I think the club included people like James and Peirce and
it's William James.
Dewey.
Yeah.
William James.
And the question was actually related to Stanford's history. Stanford challenged the tenured faculty from freely expressing political views. And some of the tenured faculty started getting fired. And they brought back some 100-year-old argument and they succeeded. But the faculty was getting replaced by people, a pipeline from Harvard, until whatever court ruled in favor of the tenured faculty. That was the beginnings of the tenured faculty's freedom to speak politically against their private university masters.
And is the respond on his comment?
Is the question, if that is a legacy of Enlightenment or the place of free speech in the Enlightenment?
Yes, pragmatism as the hallmark that I saw at that phase in the 1860s, 70s, when James and Pearson, Dewey, and those people were talking about pragmatic philosophy.
That's the only indigenous American philosophy, really. I mean, pragmatism. I think maybe we're talking about the influence of pragmatic thought or pragmatism on what was thought to be the Enlightenment.
It's always tempting to create intellectual genealogies, and Louis Menand's book, The Medical Physical Club, is about this extraordinary group of thinkers in the late 19th century, so about 100 years after the moment we're talking about, and the degree to which they may have picked up on some of these 18th century strands about what is true. How do we know what is true? And there may be links to the 18th century, but there also may not necessarily be any links. I didn't trace those specifically in my book, but that's potentially for a future project.
Again, we're talking to Caroline Winterer, and she is the author of a book all about the American Enlightenments. It's called American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. If you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, some thoughts, some questions or comments, you can join us by calling us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum at kqed.org or going right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. You can also go to our Facebook page. Many ways for you to get your thoughts in here or any questions you might have. And let me go to Jeff next. Jeff, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is I'd like to understand the differences between what was put forward by Jefferson, Franklin, et cetera, and what was put forward in the 50s and 60s via this, you know, second enlightenment, if you will. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for the question, Jeff.
Yeah. So what are some of the differences between the 18th century ideal of enlightenment with a small e and the Cold War idea of the American Enlightenment? I would say that the biggest difference is the sense in the Cold War of certainty, that the 18th century was an era of certainty, and that it was, in fact, an era of things that were done and closed and finished. When you go to the 18th century and, you know, you put your microphone up to someone like Jefferson or Adams or Madison or, you know, hundreds of others and say, what does it mean to become enlightened? They will say that it is an ongoing process of improvement, of betterment of self and society, but not only one that is never achieved, fully achieved within the span of a human life, but one over which we have a lot of uncertainty, that we do not know if what we do not know for sure if the programs that we have put into place to better human society will in fact better human society. And I will give you an example, which is their anxieties about Republican Revolution itself. Now, we assume, because we have ingested the Cold War narrative about the American Revolution as an enlightened event, that we assume that the American Revolution of throwing off a king and embracing republicanism was a move of enlightenment. But in fact, the American revolutionaries were themselves very unsure about whether this was going to get them closer to enlightenment or further away from it, because they knew that the monarchies of Europe, the great monarchies of England and France, and many other places, had used their immense cultural resources to become the cultural centers of Europe. And it would be very difficult for Americans, using the fragile institutions of republicanism, to achieve the level of enlightenment that European monarchies had achieved. They routinely used the term enlightened despot, and not necessarily negatively in the 18th century. There is, in fact, a debate in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1796, where the representatives spend 2 days debating whether it's okay to say that the United States is the most enlightened nation in the world. And they're really not sure. They have a big fight about it. And they're actually worried that if they say it, the Europeans will get angry and come and clobber them. So we assume that the move toward republicanism and away from monarchy is a move toward enlightenment. But in fact, when you go back to the 18th century and ask the revolutionaries themselves, they're not sure at all.
Now, there was also a sense that Europe had this cultivated civilization. We were kind of new and raw. I mean, you think about Trump, I think about Andrew Jackson, you know, and all these people going to the White House, storming it, you know, populism, as it was called at the time, but a kind of raw and certainly in some ways maybe neo-barbaric populism. What you're saying kind of ties in with an American belief in progress and advancement, but always over that loomed the idea that somehow, I call it neo-Calvinism also, that some idea that we may have been indeed destined for something, but destined also for the fact that there was a predestination behind our destiny.
Perhaps. This was a strand, because that's a religious reading or way of understanding their goals, that was perhaps suppressed in the late 18th century in favor of more secular ways of perceiving human abilities. But it certainly comes back full force in the 19th century, this Calvinist reading of American destiny.
There's a question from David who says, you're discussing what's wrong with the idea of the American Enlightenment, but you haven't really described what the idea is that your guest is demolishing. You say Obama echoes it. Did people not celebrate the Founding Fathers before the Cold War?
People celebrated the Founding Fathers before the Cold War. They celebrated them even more during the Cold War. And that's what's astonishing when you look at the historical record. Of course, there's founder veneration going on from the moment that the founders themselves are around. They take great care to curate their legacy, which is to our great benefit. They left behind a huge paper trail, which we can now read with a lot of pleasure and profit. But it's remarkable during the Cold War, how this veneration of not just the founders, but of a thing called the American Enlightenment, which is a genealogical legacy of freedom, and especially what they called a free society, which is a Cold War term. It did not exist in the 18th century, but the American Enlightenment of the Cold War venerates the free society of the American Revolution as the great achievement of the Americans on the world stage. But free society is a category of the Cold War. It contrasts with the closed society of the Soviet Union. So we always have to be careful about what is truly from one era and what is truly from another era.
Getting some comments. Let me read some of these comments and then some questions. Gene says, I'm from a far-left family who was brought up to question American exceptionalism. We were talking about this as recently as Thanksgiving, especially in view of the recent election. We had lots of questions, not many answers. Can't wait to read your book and learn more about the real history of the origins of our country. And Carol tweets along those lines, very interesting, refreshing to hear the professor decouple history from specific dates. History is really more of a wave phenomenon. And some questions. Ben says, it seems the periods of enlightenment in the United States have been stymied by religious revivals. Were there times when both religion and enlightenments ran in parallel?
Oh, there were. I'm so glad that this person has written in. We often think of the Enlightenment as being opposed to religion, but it's very, very important to remember that it was essentially impossible to think outside of religious categories in the 18th century, and that a lot of what self-described enlightened people were trying to do was to create a better religion, a religion that would bring them closer to God, closer to the nature that they thought that God inhabited. How could they do that? Well, they would get rid of all of the kind of irritating superstructure, or what they thought was the irritating superstructure of the church and, you know, these rules and that theology and all of these things that had been created by kind of, you know, scheming priestly demagogues and other malevolent religious figures. And what they wanted to do was to see the divine engineer at work, the God that put the planets into motion and made the flies fly through the air and put seashells in the top of mountains for them to discover. That's what they wanted. And so it really, at some level, the Enlightenment is a profoundly religious movement, but it is religious in a different way. It is religious outside the church. It sets us up for the environmentalists, the first environmentalists of the 19th century, Thoreau and Emerson, who see God in every trembling leaf. And it's really the deep, deep history of the modern environmental movement today as well.
And that transcendentalist movement was also happening, of course, on the continent, particularly in England. And again, there was that transatlantic, you used the word superstructure a couple of times. I believe it's Frederick Jameson's word, and it's often associated with Marxism.
I think I'm using it without any Marxist overtones.
You don't have any historian Marxist associated? Were you now or have you ever been? No, I just couldn't help thinking about that with Jameson. Let me get another caller on here. Ari joins us from Petaluma. Ari, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
So, fascinating conversation, and you mentioned Franklin earlier and perhaps other founding fathers. I was recently at the Franklin Museum in Philadelphia, which is very technology-rich, and it's a charming representation of his achievements, and a lot of them had to do with his technological innovations. And I just wanted to ask if, you know, he was compared to a rock star by some former caller, and I was wondering if anyone...
I think we lost that caller. But I think he was asking a connection between the innovators now and Ben Franklin, like the disruptors, the Silicon Valley people and so forth. Do you see that?
So I guess, well, I'll take your ending of the beginning of what sounded like a fascinating question. Franklin was definitely an innovator, and that came hand in hand with this idea of fixing the human condition now during the Enlightenment. And so we could add not just Franklin to that category, so someone who's willing to throw off received opinion. Thomas Paine was another one who just took pleasure in emancipating himself from received opinion. He didn't footnote common sense. Maybe some of your readers remember reading Common Sense in their high school history classes, the short pamphlet that essentially caused the American Revolution.
I remember thinking how subversive it was.
Oh, it's totally subversive. It's anti-empire. It's anti-monarchy. It's hilarious and dark and all of these wonderful things, but it doesn't have any footnotes. And a lot of 18th century texts had huge footnotes that took up the whole page because you always wanted to cite your authorities. And Thomas Paine was the first to begin to break down that idea that in order to do something, you wanted to cite the past. And he said, no, I'm going to cite the oracle of my own mind. This is Thomas Paine, and you know, he had an ally in Ben Franklin. And so this is very much the legacy of the Enlightenment.
Looking at an article here, a comment here from a listener says, I think the true genius of our American experiment is that for the first time in the modern age, a people demonstrated that an idea or a conversation could generate a new civilization in the world. And a listener writes, William Gibson said the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. Would Professor Winter say the same of the Enlightenments then and now?
Well, it was the people who lived during the 18th century who came up with the categories of barbarity and civilization that we continue to use.
It's also the noble savage.
Today, yeah, absolutely. And they were the first ones to look around the different peoples living in the earth, which had now been, you know, globalization is not something happening now, right? It began to happen from about 1492 onward. They looked around at the diversity of human populations and they said, well, some are more advanced than others. Europeans and white Americans are the most advanced and the most civilized, and there's these other peoples who seem to be stuck in a time warp. It was the Enlightenment that gave us those categories, and we continue to find it very difficult to release ourselves from those categories. What I always say is that everybody's in the present. And, you know, in fact, it was one of the things that the American revolutionaries said. They said, republics are about the now. Monarchies are fossils of the benighted past. But, you know, when you look at that, you say, well, no, that's not true. Monarchies are not only then in the 1800s, monarchies are still around now. Look, the Queen of England, she's still there, and there's no sign.
With more power, Saudi Arabia and places like that.
Yeah, so monarchies are not of the past. They're of the present.
Boy, here's a question we could open up for a whole hour on, but we've come to the end of the hour. A listener wants to know, how do you respond to a common attitude today that we should disregard the ideas of founding fathers since they were just a bunch of old white male slaveholders?
Ah. We disregard them as our peril. These are people who wrote some things that we don't like today, some things that we do like today. But what I say to my students is that we should not disparage or venerate. We should understand. That is the greatest duty that we have to the past.
Good note to end on. Caroline Winter, thank you so much for joining us. Caroline Winter, again, January 17th, will be at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. She's professor of history and director of the Stanford Humanities Center, and her book is American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. General manager is Joanne Wallace. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.